Our speaker is Brother Mark Vincent. The theme for Brother Vincent's class this week is Exploring the Psalms. Today's class is entitled, How Psalms Work.
Well, good morning, everyone. We seem to have lost half of the audience, but hopefully they'll join us in due course. New poetry was off-putting, but I didn't think it was quite that bad. So hopefully you've all got handouts. If you don't, there are brothers on the doors with handouts, so please go and grab one if you haven't got one, because we will be using it, and we'll be using it through every class this week. So please keep it with you, and hopefully you've got something to write with. So I'd like us to begin by thinking about the fact that there are different types of writing. Now, if you're reading a romantic novel, for example, you would read it in a different kind of way to the way that you would read the weather forecast online. And you would read it in a different way to the way in which you would read a mortgage document issued by your bank that you had to sign. There are different types of literature, aren't there? There's sort of high literature, there's legal writing, there's factual writing, there's the style of writing that you would find in a textbook, and of course there is poetry. Now, the Bible contains rather a lot of poetry, and it's worth thinking about these different expectations, these different sets of approaches that we need for different types of writing. So hopefully I've illustrated that even in everyday life, this is quite normal. You know, you read a legal document carefully and you pore over what the implications of those terms and conditions might be, because you know that if you sign on that line, you're going to be on the hook. Whereas there's some kinds of writing that you can just skim through very quickly. Now, the scriptures contain within them different kinds of writing. And to some extent, those different types of writing work in different ways. So when we read some of the legal material in the scriptures, in the book of Leviticus, for example, it's different, isn't it? It just feels different. It uses different language. It uses different sentence structures to what it would be like to read the gospel, a gospel. A gospel is narrative, obviously, and that's more like what it would be like to read Samuel or Kings or Chronicles. But even there are some different conventions between those two different types of narratives. And when we read poetry, it's different again. So in order to be good Bible readers, we need to think about what the right way is of approaching reading poetry. Now, one thing I think we'd all recognize straight away is that it's no use speed reading poetry, is it? If you try that, you're just not going to get the benefit out of it. You're going to miss the depth, the richness of the language and the imagery that's being used. So poetry needs time. You need to just sit there and let the words wash over you. And of course, it's a principle of Bible study that that when you're studying a passage of scripture, you should read it and read it and read it and read it again, and do that just repeatedly. You can't do it too much. And I would say that with poetry, that's even more the case, because there are just so many gems hidden there in the way in which the language works. Now, for some of us, though, this might be a bit of a scary thing. I mean, we could almost divide the world into two types. There are people who, you know, are okay with poetry, and then there are the rest of us. Poetry can be a bit scary, and we might have had bad experiences of it at school. We might think, you know, all that airy-fairy language doesn't do anything for me. Well, if that is the case, then there are reasons to take heart, because Bible poetry is quite different to the English poetry that we might have been familiar with from our English lit classes at school. And it's also true as well that as we grow up and mature, I think poetry is something that gets better with age, not the age of the poetry, but with our age. As we grow in our life experiences, in our own maturity, emotional maturity, perhaps our potential to appreciate poetry can also deepen. But the good news is that Bible poetry is different to English poetry or French poetry. So whatever your experience of poetry might have been, please don't despair at this point. We are going to be talking about poetry throughout this session, i.e. this particular class, but there really isn't very much technical to it, and hopefully we'll quickly be engaging with some Bible texts which will be interesting and relevant. I do want to emphasize that this is important because when we talk about Bible poetry, we're not just talking about the Psalms. We're also talking about Proverbs. We're also talking about large parts of Ecclesiastes. We're talking about most of the book of Job. And we're talking about most of the writing of the prophets also. So when you add all that together, and bear in mind that there are actually quite a few poetic passages in some of the narrative books as well, what we're saying is probably something like a half to two-thirds of the Bible is actually written in biblical poetry. So the more we can understand about how this poetry works and how to benefit from it, how to be good readers of it, the better it will be for our Bible reading and study. So let's ask a question. What makes a poem a poem? And we'll start to think about that in terms of English poetry, but we'll do that to draw the comparison and to see how Bible poetry is different. So when you think about English poetry, probably the first thing you think about is rhyme, don't you? Tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forest of the night, or the version that I prefer, tiger, tiger, burning bright, how can you see without a light? To separate your foes from friendies, you must be wearing contact lenses. Which I don't think was what was originally written. The difficulty with rhyme is that when you take a rhyming poem and you translate it into another language, it usually doesn't rhyme anymore. So if your poetry is based on rhyme, you've got a problem. You know, if Hebrew poetry was all about rhyme, then we'd lose so much of it, wouldn't we, when we were reading it in English, because the rhymes wouldn't work. But guess what? Hebrew poetry doesn't rhyme. And so that's not a problem that we have. What else then might we think of in terms of poetry? Well, we might think of meter, of rhythm. And I found an American example of this. This is apparently the first American limerick that is on record, and having lived on the East Coast myself for a little while, it's somewhat close to home for me as well. There once was a man from Nantucket who kept all his cash in a bucket. But his daughter, named Nan, ran away with the man, and as for the bucket, Nan took it. Now, again, you know, imagine that in Chinese, and, you know, Nantucket would probably still sound like Nantucket, but the word bucket would not rhyme with Nantucket, would it? So, actually, a reply was written to that particular limerick, which went like this. But he followed the pair to Pawtucket, the man and the girl with the bucket, and he said to the man, he was welcome to Nan, but as for the bucket, Pawtucket. And then a reply was written to that one, which went like this. Then the pair followed Pa to oh, sorry, I'll start that one again. These places are getting less and less familiar to me. Then the pair followed Pa to Manhasset, where he still held the cash as an asset. But Nan and the man stole the money and ran. And as for the bucket, Manhasset. And I'm going to stop with that. But you're all familiar with limericks. That's how it works, isn't it? And we could, you know, we could sit there and try and compose our own. Because there's a framework, there's a template that a limerick must conform to. Well, again, you start translating a poem into another language, and what's going to happen to the meter? It's not going to be there anymore, chances are. Guess what? Hebrew poetry doesn't really use meter in any very strong way. In fact, scholars are still debating, even now, after hundreds of years on this particular topic, whether Hebrew poetry has meter or not. And the fact that they're still debating it and debating whether you should count syllables or whether you should count, count phrases, this kind of thing, shows that the answer is probably that it doesn't have any meter to it. Otherwise, the answer would have been more obvious. So again, that's good news for us, because it means that when we read Hebrew poetry, we're not losing out by not having the rhythm, because there wasn't any particular rhythm in the original anyway. Well, we're doing a good job of saying what Hebrew poetry isn't like. What about what it is like? Well, I want to pick on four particular aspects, and we're going to illustrate each of these from the Psalms. But first of all, let's just say what they are. Repetition. And of course, once you've got a word, you can repeat it and repeat it and repeat it, and you translate that word into a different language, and you can still repeat the same word, can't you? So repetition translates perfectly well. So it's just a great example of God using precisely the right tools. He's chosen to make the Bible in a language which has a lot of poetry in it, but where that poetry translates really effectively into foreign languages of whatever type. So we've got repetition. We've got imagery. We've got parallelism, where one line parallels the next line. And we've got what we might call shape or structure. And all of those things translate across languages. Let me just say those again. Repetition, imagery, parallelism, and shape or structure. So we'll get in a moment to looking at some examples of that in the Psalms. But before we do, we might just want to ask the question, why do human beings bother with poetry at all? Why do we have poetry? What's it for? Why does the Bible use it? And there are a number of ways that we can answer that, and here are a couple of them. One writer described poetry as saying things oft thought but ne'er so well expressed. Things oft thought but ne'er so well expressed. And that's exactly what a good poem should do. It should take something which you know or which you feel and should express it with particular poignancy, with particular power, so that you can read the poem and say, yep, that's right, that's exactly it. So if it's a poem about a tiger, that you can sort of see the tiger and even feel the tiger or be scared of the tiger as you're reading the poem. It takes, it's a use of language, obviously, but it takes language from being sort of two-dimensional, flat on the page, and makes it come alive before us. That's the purpose of poetry. Another way of thinking about it is to take something that we're familiar with and to transform our perception of it, to make us see something in a new way. That's what poetry can do. It can heighten our experience of things, to change words from just being about things to actually becoming those things, if you like. It's this three-dimensional aspect of it that is so important. And the emotional aspect. You know, obviously I can say, I feel sad. But my saying, I feel sad, doesn't make you feel sad, does it? But if I was to recite a really good poem about feeling sad, then that would start to make you relate to what it means to feel sad, wouldn't it? And pretty soon we'd all be feeling sad. Well, we're not going to do that. We are going to do that. It's Psalm 6. It's the psalm on your handout. So you don't need your Bible open for this, but please just look at the front page of your handout. And what you can see there on the top left is Psalm 6, as it might look in your Bible, if you've got an AV or a KJV. Now, one of the problems, if your Bible works like that, is that it doesn't look much like a poem, does it? It just looks like a continuous block of text. And I find one of the helpful things to do is straight away is to lineate it, i.e. to break it into lines of poetry. And if you look below that, so the bottom left of the page, you'll see that's exactly the same psalm again. And we've just now put a little bit more space around it, and we've broken it down into poetic lines. Now, you know, it seems like do I really need to do that? Well, possibly not, but it's really helpful if you do, I would suggest. because it just starts to get you into that poetic mindset, and you can see easier how one half of the verse relates to the next, how one line relates to the next line. So, we're going to do a little exercise here. Nothing clever about this, just a simple exercise. What we're going to do is try and strip the poetry away. We're going to, as it were, suck the poetry out of the psalm and convert it just into very simple, unpoetic sentences, so that we can then compare what it is that the poem, that the poetry, that the use of language is bringing to the table. And you see, I've done that for the first stanza there. So the poem says, "O Lord, rebuke me not in thine anger, neither chasten me in thy hot displeasure." And I've summarized that on the right as, "Lord, do not be too angry with me." Now, you may be able to come up with a better summary. I'm not saying there's no right answers to this. I'm not saying my summary is the right answer. It's just one quick attempt at making a summary at what those words are saying. In the most simple language that a child would understand, not poetic, taking out the imagery. And so it goes on. "Take pity on me. I am weak and need help. How long will I wait?" Now, what I'd like you to do is spend a couple of minutes looking down at the other lines of the psalm and just try to write your own little summary on the right-hand side. So, simple language, short as you can. What is the content that underlies the poetry here? And I'll just be quiet for a minute while you do that. Okay, so let me cut back in at that point. You're probably not finished, but that's something perhaps if you're interested to do so, you can do that in your own time. But hopefully, just from that little exercise, you can start to see, you know, which version would you prefer? Would you prefer the simplified version with the poetry stripped away, or would you prefer the actual version, the version that God has given us? And I'm sure we'd all agree that the version that God has given is far better, isn't it? Because with that version, we can actually enter into how awful it must have felt like for David in this circumstance. And what that means is that when I feel awful and when you feel awful, we may not be as eloquent as David, might we? And we would not be guided by the Holy Spirit in the same way either. But the great thing is that even though I may not find the words to say, I can turn to the scriptures and I can find words that express the grief, the frustration, the anger, perhaps, that I feel, and I'm able to bring that to God through these words that the psalm has. So we can see then that the poetry is really adding a huge amount. It's bringing this three-dimensionality to the content of the psalm. Now, let's notice some of the other things that we said were characteristic of Bible poetry in this psalm. We won't talk about repetition. We're going to look at repetition in a moment. But what about imagery? What kind of imagery did we find there in the psalm? Well, let's have a look at verses 6 and 7. "I am weary with my groaning. All the night make I my bed to swim. I water my couch with my tears." Now that's pretty powerful imagery, isn't it? All night I make my bed to swim. So his grief is such, and there's no stop to it. It just keeps pouring out of him, and he can't stem the flow. And he's converting his bed into a swimming pool by the depth of his grief here. "I water my couch with my tears," and it's now as if his couch has become a garden. It was a swimming pool, now it's a garden, and he's watering it with his tears, just like the rain would fall on a garden. And imagery like that is used elsewhere in the psalm as well. So one of the things to do when we find imagery is to just stop and think to ourselves, what is the image here? And why is that image powerful? How does it work? How does it explain what it is that the psalmist feels or what it is that he's describing? We'll take another look at imagery in a moment. What we would also notice here is parallelism. And you can see that in the first line. O Lord, rebuke me not in thine anger, neither chasten me in thy hot displeasure. And of course, chasten goes with rebuke, doesn't it? Rebuke me not, chasten me not, and anger goes with hot displeasure. Now, this is one of the most characteristic features of Hebrew poetry, that usually it comes in pairs of lines, a first line and a second line, and there's often a pattern between the two lines. And I'd like to read you out some examples of parallelism that have numbers in them, and let's see if we can spot the pattern of what's going on with these numbers. If Cain be avenged sevenfold, truly Lamech 70 and sevenfold. How should one chase 1,000 and two put 10,000 to flight? Six things doth the Lord hate, yea, seven are an abomination to him. That our sheep may bring forth thousands and 10,000s in our streets.
Saul has slain his thousands, but David his 10,000s. What did you notice about the number in the second line? It's bigger. On every occasion, it's bigger. I mean, it would be bizarre if it said, Saul has slain his thousands and David his hundreds, wouldn't it? Or for three transgressions and for two. Always the second number is the bigger number. And what that little pattern is doing is helping us understand how parallelism works, because usually, not in every single case, but in most cases, the second line is an intensification of the first line. So it's thousands in the first line and it's 10,000s in the second line. And it's anger in the first line and it's hot displeasure in the second line. And that's more descriptive, isn't it, than anger. It's stronger, it's more precise. So it might be, there might be a homing in, a focusing, or there might be an expanding out, a stepping up in the second line. But usually we've got this movement from the first line to an intensification in the second line. So thinking about the parallelism can be helpful to us too. Beyond that, I'd just like to just pick out a couple of things from this Psalm 6, just to again to think about how it speaks to us as a psalm. The verse 1 again, O Lord, rebuke me not in thine anger, neither chasten me in thy hot displeasure. It's almost the language of victimization, isn't it? That David feels that God has something against him, that God is rebuking him and chastening him. And We don't know from the psalm what it is, why that would be the case, what it is that is driving that. And sometimes that's exactly how it can feel, can't it? The situations are occurring in our lives and we don't know why it is. And it feels as though we're somehow being blocked in, hedged in, forced into a corner by circumstances that are taking place. And that God is somehow bringing this upon us. And we don't know what to do about it and how to react to it. What about the aching in verse 2? Have mercy upon me, O Lord, for I am weak. O Lord, heal me, for my bones are vexed. It goes beyond just saying healing me. Even his very bones are aching. That's how demoralized he feels. My soul also is sore vexed. His very self feels this vexation. But thou, O Lord, how long? And what are you doing about it, Lord? Why is it taking you so long to respond to me? How long will I wait? That's the thought here, isn't it? The abandonment that he feels. Return, O Lord, deliver my soul. Where have you gone, Lord? Come back. And of course, we know intellectually that God has never gone away, that he's always present and everywhere present. God never goes away, and yet sometimes it feels as though he has, doesn't it? And this psalm expresses that feeling of estrangement and abandonment, and it does so in a very powerful way. And in fact, God's having gone away makes him feel close to death itself, for in death, there is no remembrance of thee. In the grave, who shall give thee thanks? The weight of death there presses upon him. And he has this inescapable grief. We talked about the tears of his, didn't we? But then the psalm concludes with this confident assertion that despite the wretchedness that he currently feels, that God will ultimately vindicate him. Well, that's all we're going to say about Psalm 6 for the moment. Let's take another example of imagery, and this is one we will need to turn to in our Bibles, and this is from Psalm 52. Why boastest thou thyself in mischief, O mighty man? The goodness of God endureth continually. Thy tongue deviseth mischief like a sharp razor working deceitfully. You see how there's the contrast between what God is like and what this enemy is like. But really, the reason for looking at this was just to notice that image in verse 2. Thy tongue deviseth mischief like a sharp razor working deceitfully. Now, if you had to come up with an analogy for the tongue, with an image for the tongue, wouldn't a razor be one of the last things that you would think of? I mean, physically speaking, a tongue is about as unlike a razor as you can get, isn't it? Because it's soft and squishy. It doesn't have a definite form, and you couldn't cut anything with it. That's what you have your teeth for. And this is always the thing about images. There's a sense in which it is like, and there's a sense in which it is not like. So, you know, when Solomon in the Song of Songs compares the woman's teeth to a flock of sheep, I mean, there's a way in which that is not flattering, isn't there? But of course, so that's the is not like sense of it. A woman should not generally be compared to a sheep, but there's a sense in which the whiteness of a sheep is like the teeth. So there is an is and there isn't. And here too, the tongue being like a razor working deceitfully. And a tongue is nothing like a razor, and yet the way this tongue is used is exactly like a razor. And maybe we might put that into a more clinical setting. Of like a scalpel. If we were writing the psalm, that incisive, that ability that a scalpel has, that a razor has, that lethal potential that it has. And then in verse 4, we've got some more imagery which is quite powerful. Thou lovest all devouring words, O thou deceitful tongue. Now again, it's not the tongue that devours, is it? It's teeth that devour. But this is a tongue that wants to play at being the teeth. And this implement is being misused then for a false and a wrong purpose. God shall likewise destroy thee forever. He shall take thee away and pluck thee out of thy dwelling place and root thee out of the land of the living. And how about that for an image of someone getting hold of your tongue and pulling it out of your mouth? That's the image there, isn't it? That's a pretty aggressive and violent image which captures well what is to be done with someone who uses their tongue in this despicable way. Doeg the Edomite, that's the setting for this psalm, has done. So, some powerful examples of the use of imagery there. What about repetition? We want to say a little bit about repetition, and then if we've got time, a little bit about shape. Well, for repetition, let's turn to Psalm 47. And we'll come in at verse 6. Sing praises to God. Sing praises. Sing praises unto our King. Sing praises. For God is the King of all the earth. Sing ye praises with understanding. Well, it's not difficult to spot what the repetition is there, is it? It's sing praises. So this is a psalm which is all about singing praises to God. It's a psalm of rejoicing. Now, when you get a verse like that, two verses like that, the repetition is so obvious that it sort of doesn't need pointing out. But except that, it serves as a little clue. It makes you think, I wonder where else this psalm talks about singing praises or about rejoicing. Well, let's have a look at that. So just scan through the psalm and see what other references we've got to rejoicing. Can you see anything in verse 1? Clap your hands, the voice of triumph, right? Those are words of rejoicing, aren't they? What about verse 2? Not so much in verse 2. What would be another verse? Verse 5, God has gone up with a shout, the Lord with the sound of a trumpet. More language of rejoicing and praise. Any others? Verse 5 and 6 we've looked at. Verse 7 we looked at. Verse 9. Yep. He is greatly exalted. And there's this gathering of peoples together, isn't there? Presumably to worship God. So what's useful here, and if there's one thing that I'd like you to take away, if there's one thing about studying the Psalms that I found to be the most helpful thing, and it is this. It's simply to have the Psalm, either write out the Psalm, either do it by hand or type it out, or if you've got it there on the computer, then just copy and paste it and print it out with plenty of space around it so that you can just write and scribble and so that you can notice. It doesn't matter if you write something that's wrong, you can always cross it out. And just note down, we talked about these different aspects of Bible poetry and how it works. Probably the most important one of all in terms of really making sure we understand what the particular piece of writing that we're studying is about is this one of repetition. And just highlight, so for this one in Psalm 47, we could just go through and we could circle all those references to rejoicing that we've just looked at. So what we've identified now then is one like thematic chain going through the psalm, haven't we? This language of rejoicing. But that's not the only one. Can anyone spot another set of words that are about, that are linked together here? Okay, yeah, what we've got here then is this regal language, the language of kingship. So let's have a look for that. So verse 2, the Lord Most High is terrible, he is a great king. Verse 6, sing praises unto our king. Verse 7, for God is king over all the earth. Verse 8, God reigneth, God sitteth on the throne. Verse 9, potentially, the shields of the earth belong unto God. In other words, people are bringing their military power and laying it at God's feet, implies his kingship, doesn't it? So now we've got another chain of references, so maybe we'd want to underline all these. So whatever this psalm is about, we must take on board this background of praise, but we must also take on this idea of the kingship of God is central to what this psalm is about. So that's great. Can you see another set of words that's repeated or themes that's repeated through this psalm? Peoples and nations, fantastic. So we won't look all those up. I'll leave that one for you to have a look at yourself. But I think there are about 8 references to peoples, nations, the earth, these kind of things. I mean, the psalm's only 9 verses long, isn't it? So is that right? 9 verses? Yep. So that's quite a lot of references to peoples and nations, isn't it? in the space of one short psalm. So we've got another dynamic going on. Any more? Well, we're getting a bit short of time, so I'll jump in with this one. It's the idea of height, of that which is high and that which is low, of exaltation and submission. Let's just look at a couple of those. Verse 2, "For the Lord Most High is terrible. He is a great king over all the earth." And again, verse 3, "He shall subdue the peoples under us and the nations under our feet." Verse 5, "God is gone up with a shout." Verse 8, "God reigneth over the nations. God sitteth upon the throne of his holiness." And verse 9, "God is greatly exalted," which implies that he's high, doesn't it? So it's not just one set of repetitions in that psalm, is it? It's at least four different sets of extensive, again and again and again, repetitions. Now, of course, if you just read that psalm once through, you don't notice any of that. You've got to read it through again and again and again. And, you know, just again, just having the pencil or perhaps different colors or using dots and circles and underlines and squiggles, however you like to do it. And when you do that, you start, all right, I can see things in this psalm. I could begin to appreciate more about it. And I can then work from there to an understanding of what it is that the psalm might be describing, what its setting might be, what it describes, and how it might speak to me in my life, and how it might speak to you in yours. How it might encourage us, for example, in the case of this psalm, to have this sense of God's greatness, his exaltedness, to have this vision of a time when all nations and people over all the earth, that's the horizontal direction, will be subject to him, and he will put all things under his feet. How it might make us think of the time when the ark was carried up to Jerusalem and God went up, as it were, his presence enshrined on the ark, went up into the city of Jerusalem with a great shout and with the rejoicing of David and the distribution of gifts to all, and how it might suit that context, for example. So the repetition gives us those really helpful clues. Well, it's nearly time to finish. We've just got 2 minutes, 3 minutes to say a little bit about shape. We'll be seeing a lot more of this during the week, so it doesn't matter that we're just taking a brief look now. Again, just look at the front page of your handout, and you'll see there a little verse, two verses from Psalm 12. And you can see underneath I've put a little structure, a little ABCD structure. And I'd like you to see if you can spot the key word that makes, the key words that match, the B's, the C's, and the D's. So I've given you the first one. The Lord shall cut off all flattering lips. And at the end it says that the wicked say, "Who is Lord over us?" So you've got a Lord at the beginning and a Lord at the end. The B is lips. Yep. The Lord shall cut off all flattering lips, and working back from the end, our lips are our own. Who is Lord over us? What about the C? The tongue. Yep. The tongue that speaks proud things, with our tongue will we prevail. What about the D? Speak or said. Yes, that's the thing that comes in the middle, isn't it? So we better watch what we say, hadn't we? It's a pretty pattern at one level, but again, there's a point behind it, that what we say, whether we speak proud things, and the kinds of things that we say, will be absolutely critical to what our fate will ultimately be. And there are basically two poles here. There's one pole, which we have aligned ourselves to, we hope, that is one which recognizes God's authority and that recognizes that he is Lord. That's the A. But then, in contrast to that, the A at the end, there is those who say, who is Lord over us? I am my own Lord, my own boss. And there's the antithesis between those two attitudes, isn't there? And we've got to pick our camp. We've got to make sure that the things that we say are things that prove that we believe that he is indeed our Lord and our God. Let's conclude this little overview of what makes Bible, some of the things that make Bible poetry interesting and exciting, with a quick look on page 2 of your handout, Psalm 58. And we don't have time to talk about this now, but I'd just like to give it to you as a, well, almost a bit of homework, if I'm allowed to do such a thing. And what you might like to do is, you see, I've set it out with four lines at the beginning and four lines at the end. And if you compare those two sets of four lines, you'll see all kinds of links between the four lines at the beginning and the four lines at the end. And you'll see words that link between the beginning and the end, and you'll see there's a contrast in the message. So there's a state of things as they are now in the four lines at the top of the psalm, and there's a state of things as they will be at the end in the four lines at the bottom of the psalm. So this psalm charts a movement from the beginning, as things are now, to the end, when God will be judge over all the earth. And then, of course, there are some verses in the middle, and there are all kinds of things to spot there, too, that I'm not going to tell you about, other than to say, look out for the animals. And we'll leave it there.